Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast, a conversation where good thoughts help renew the mind with the Word of God. You're here with Tim, Charlie, Andy, and Josh. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Zoharim Tovim.
Whoa, Tim mixing it up.
It's good afternoon in Hebrew.
Oh, not that mixed up.
No.
Hello.
Greetings and salutations, listener. Welcome to our podcast.
Yeah, and we have so much fun and leisure planned today on our episode.
It is the basis of our culture.
Can those things really... That was good.
I know. I'm good, Tim.
Those things...
Just said the title of the book. I actually worked it in. It was like segue-ish. She just said the title.
This is called co-opting.
Well done.
Look
good
at me,
co-opting.
Tim. Look at me.
Look at these language guys. They don't understand us literature guys.
Oh, boy.
That was an off-air conversation.
That's a good one.
All right. You know what I realized that we haven't done since we are doing this in the afternoon?
What?
We have practically ended our what are we drinking
part of the... I know. It's sad.
Like, we don't have a coffee that we've brewed at this point.
I'm drinking water.
True.
I'm drinking peach green tea because I have horrible sinus congestion and a mild headache.
Mm. I'm drinking a poppy.
Oh, I love poppies. Those are
good. They are good.
Yeah.
I am parched. not really, but I don't have a beverage.
We should start drinking bubblers again because Tim on an afternoon bubbler is just great.
That's a slippery slope.
It is a slippery slope.
All right, so what we are
get a bunch
do,
of them and put them in the seminary fridge downstairs.
Oh, there you go.
Put a do not touch on them or something. Yep. Ooh, that's not a bad idea.
That didn't stop seminary students in the past. Meaning me, I would take stuff. Anyway.
Confession is good for the soul.
Hey, we didn't even have a seminary fridge in a seminary building when I was in seminary. It was just eating like Dr. Myron's old-fashioned donut before you could get to it.
Well, that's right. I do remember that.
And he was pretty particular.
He would get really
donuts.
Like mad.
Yeah.
Or particular.
So, earlier this week, we had the seminary Q&A. And I did have a moment where I was like, the role that I am fulfilling at this seminary Q&A is the Myron role. It's the single goofy guy who like makes quips about things, you know, here and there. And that I was like, oh, I think Myron would be proud.
I think you embodied it well. I really do.
We are similarly bodied. No.
Oh, my word.
Oh, is that not what you... Oh, anyway.
No, that's not what I meant.
All right. Well...
But I do think the Q&A went really well. That was like, that's got to be one of the biggest Q&As with the most interactive questions and whatnot.
A well-bodied Q&A.
There it is. Very full.
Books and business.
Hey, Tim.
Thank you, Tim.
Oh, actually, there was some other things that I wanted to say.
Weren't
before.
You supposed to say something after I said books and business?
We're going to talk about some books.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Josh, to cut right in here. But I do want to say two things. I told him I would do it. I told him I would do it on air. Listener Jeff Dilliard, I talked with him today, and he says hello to all of you. Would you like to share any public comments about Jeff on the podcast?
Jeff, it's good to hear from you, man. We miss you. That's all I got.
You don't have to. I was just looking around.
I didn't have anything prepared.
All right. And then we did receive, we have received a plethora of emails over the last...
A plethora?
2 months or so. Big body. Man, that's the theme of the episode, is it not? Okay. Man. So, we had a listener email in. And Elena from California... Thank you for emailing in about the schedule of The Weight of Glory. The question you said, is it posted anywhere? It is not. It's just mentioned in some episodes. So in the absence of posting it somewhere, let me walk through that again. We had an introductory episode, and we've talked about the inner ring and is theology poetry? That's 280, 283, and 285. Coming up, episode 287 will be on transposition, the essay transposition, posting on March 10th. Then on March 24th, posting Why I'm Not a Pacifist. And on April 7th, we will then have the final and the namesake, the token, if it will, if you will, the Weight of Glory essay will be on April 7th. So that's the schedule, and sorry for not posting it, but there they are.
I did forget also,
we're going to make you say it again.
My ETS proposal was accepted. And so this is Midwest. This is regional. This is not that big of a deal.
It's still.
Anyway.
It is.
So I'm going to be in Grand Rapids. Huh?
You mean Grand Rapids? GR?
Yeah.
Oh, man. There's a good coffee shop there.
It's March 21st. I present in the morning on March 21st. The 20th and 21st, Dr. Doug, Dr. Paul, and myself are all going. So I'll be presenting on The Female Lover and Her Foil, the four primary characters of the Song of Songs. And I have an abstract written, and that is it. So guess what I'm going to be doing for about the next month.
Will you present that?
That is a Saturday. It would be fun. You guys could maybe come sometime. So,
well, I was actually just messaging with Jonathan Fuller, better known as Baptist Theology, on Instagram.
Dude, that's going really well for him, by the way.
People like Baptist Theology.
Seriously. And his posts are great.
Yeah, and so I would love to go out, and I have a place to stay. So,
I think we're staying with him.
If you go, you have to bring You have to bring us a bag of Mac.
Fuller, get out of here. You're gonna house the littles.
You could look at coming. Doug and I are driving, and then Paul's already there.
Okay. Okay. Well, that was a huge detour. Are we ready? No. You gotta say it again. It's been too long.
Books and business.
All right. There we go. Let's talk about some books.
Well, I'm going to go first. I'm leading the content today on Leisure, the Basis of Culture by Josef Pieper. But I wanted to set the record straight on something that I've been unintentionally giving false information. I've been saying that line that's at the end of Is Theology Poetry? I've been saying that I think I encountered that in Meditation in a Tool Shed, and I did not encounter that in Meditation in a Tool Shed.
Confession is good for the soul.
That's right. But the concept is in this essay. He begins, and in the second paragraph, he says, looking along the beam and looking at the beam are very different experiences. And so he discusses that in relationship to Christianity at some point as well. So that's kind of what I was thinking. But that quotation is not in this essay.
Are you confident it's not in another essay?
I'm not confident of that.
So, because I have The God in the Dock, like the full audio version. Which, by the way, that's a value purchase. If you've got one credit for Audible, you get like all of C.S. Lewis's essays.
That's beautiful. I didn't even think about that.
That's a value pick if you're doing like an audio version. But I did not think, I don't even remember the title, but it was one of the earlier essays in like his collected essays that had that line in it. I did not think the essay was Is Theology Poetry. It may have been. But so I was kind of convinced like you that it was in another essay, but it may not actually be in another essay.
Yeah, I don't. That's all I have.
Cool.
Okay. I'm going to talk about Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis. So this last week in small group, we were talking about how God is related to time. We're going through a book on God's nature. And shout out to April Haig and Al Root, who both mentioned an illustration from Lewis in Mere Christianity of how God relates to time. So there's a section in the book called Beyond or Time and Beyond Time. And it's about, it's how God relates to time. And so here's how it came up. Just one second. I often use the illustration of the line and the dots. So like a dog, there's a dot. Okay. Imagine a dot. That's when the dog is born, and then there's a line, and then imagine another dot. That's when the dog gets run over, okay? And it's done. It's gone. It doesn't have any more existence because it's not eternal. Then you have a dot, and that's when one of us is born, and then you have this line, but that line never ends. When you die, you go to one of other two places, and you're there forever. So that's like a line that has a beginning point but no ending point. So the illustration that I always heard was God is like a line that goes eternally in both directions and has no beginning point because he's always been here. And I think that's a good illustration for what it does. But Lewis has this essay on time, and he uses a different illustration. I thought it was really good. So I got the quote here. So he says this: if you picture time as a straight line along which we have to travel, then you must picture God as the whole page on which the line is drawn. And I thought that was nice because it expands out the way we think of God's eternality. He goes on to say, we come to the parts of the line one by one. We have to leave A behind before we can get to B. And we cannot reach C until we leave behind B. God, from above or outside or all around, contains the whole line and sees it all. And I just thought that was interesting because I'd heard the line analogy, but I hadn't heard he's like the page it's written on. And to me, there's something about that that captures the both immensity and the holy otherness of God when it comes to time. Anyways, I thought that was an interesting illustration. Page 168 in my edition of Mere Christianity. Hope you enjoyed that.
What I have here is a commentary. It is part of the Zondervan Exegetical Commentary series of the New Testament, and it is on Galatians. And this Sunday, I am preaching at my church in Galatians, and so have been reading some commentaries. What's interesting is, Andy, can you read at the top right there? Is it my, yeah, top left maybe?
Yeah, 325 of 2014 with your name just above it. 2014, man.
Yeah, so this was actually a recommendation to me by friend of the podcast, Doug Brown,
hey,
back in 2014. So that's, you know, why it's fun to have a practice of like writing when you bought a book or when you read it, things like that, because it is kind of fun to be like, man, wow. 12 years ago is when I bought this.
That's really cool.
I think it was brand new at the time. It had just recently come out. And what I like about the series is it, I don't know if it's unique to just this volume, which is written by Thomas Schreiner, or if it's the whole series, but they do a really good job of doing like a visual sort of flow, sort of a diagram of sense, both ideas and of text. But it's not like Greek diagramming, like a sentence diagram, but it is very similar to that. And it is actually, when you're preparing a sermon under the gun, we might say, it is really helpful in a pinch, you know, because it does do a lot of heavy lifting for you. When I teach preaching in Preaching to Youth, which is actually one of the interesting things, is Doug recommended this to me when I was preparing a Galatians sermon in Preaching to Youth 12 years ago. And now I'm in Preaching to Youth and had a student preach from Galatians, which is fun. What I tell them is the commentary should be the last part of the process. You should read the text. You should diagram the text. You should outline the text. You should think through the theology of the text and try to fit that into your realm, like your thinking, before you run to MacArthur or Wiersbe or Schreiner or whoever it is, just so that you can't unsee it. Like you just can't unsee when a master of a craft does something, and you're going to be so tempted to borrow from them. And so one of the most valuable aspects of preaching is being who you are, like you uniquely communicating God's word through your context. The meaning of the text does not change, but the communication of it is more dynamic when you are you. And so when you start trying to be somebody else, the truth is the same, and God is still going to use it, but I don't know if the degree to which God uses it or the way God might use it to help people does change, because you are, in a sense, faking. Like, you're being somebody else. And so, you know, I'm kind of breaking my own rule. You know, I knew I had this, and I right away had some diagramming questions, and was like, oh, I'm just going to pull Schreiner off and look at it. And but yeah, we're actually, that passage I have been studying is what we're going to do for our final meditation. So we'll hear more about Galatians in a little bit. But I really like this commentary. It'd be one of my top five for Galatians.
So just a quick story about that. I didn't learn that. I learned that lesson the hard way, like many of us, where I would go to a commentary and I would pick like an exegetical commentary, and it would just mess me up. But the worst was that I was in the book of Hebrews when it happened. Oh, I know. It was like, you know, it wasn't like something much less complicated.
Nobody warned you about that?
No. Well done. Not even six times. Mm.
So context, there's the warning passages in Hebrews. All right. Tim, what are you reading over there?
So I have Complementarity by Greg Allison. I talked about this book one other time on the podcast, and I finished reading it. I'm part of another reading group with a few pastors, Cody Huber, Adam Witte, Ben Hartwig, and Marshall Felderman. And we read through this together, and we talked about it just this last Monday. It's kind of interesting. We all kind of came to the same conclusion. What Allison is essentially doing is there's the big debate between egalitarianism and complementarianism, and he's arguing for complementarity, which is different. And it's essentially a middle-of-the-road option between the two. A lot of people didn't want to, or he doesn't want to look at it or view it that way, but D.A. Carson, in his endorsement, he writes, Greg Allison's book distances itself from both complementarianism and egalitarianism, choosing a third option designated complementarity, and thus not to be confused with complementarianism. So, anyway, it was a pretty disappointing book. That's really what I have as a general statement. He goes through and he basically just presents the egal positions and then the complementary positions, and then he argues for human flourishing and peaceful living, and doesn't answer really how do you actually go about doing that. So, for example, in his conclusion, his arenas for application, he has complementarity for relational flourishing, complementarity for familial flourishing, for vocational flourishing, and ecclesial flourishing. So in other words, what do we want to do? We want to, as humans, flourish. And of course, who disagrees with that? Nobody. Okay. So for actually establishing some kind of a position, he basically just punts repeatedly. And this was the opinion, not just of myself, but we all agreed on this was kind of the conclusion. So on page 221 here, he's basically arguing for his proposal of complementarity. There are several key points, and he has first and then second, how one parses out the responsibility for the relationship between husband and wives in their marriages in a broken world. Okay, and he's arguing for marital flourishing. And then I'm going to read his quote now. How they live out such divine design is largely left to their wisdom-aided and spirit-empowered discretion. Both complementarians and egalitarians should use caution and discernment when their applications of complementarity are different from those of others. Certainly, there are expressions within both camps that violate complementarity, and married couples must forego such expressions at the same time. A wide diversity of applications exists and should be respected. So, concerning like complementarity in the home, what should you do? Well, there's going to be a variety of different decisions that need to be made, and what do we need to use? Wisdom-aided and spirit-empowered discretion. Okay, so in other words, how do we go about making these decisions in the home?
You just figure it out and be wise.
That's it. You figure it out and be wise. So there's essentially no biblical parameters. There's simply do what's right in your own eyes. You use wisdom-aided and spirit-empowered discretion. What? I thought you were going to say something.
I'm thinking about saying something.
Okay, you don't have to say anything. That's fine. So,
unhinged, Charlie.
We all kind of came to the same conclusion that this is what he does because, you know, particularly within the Southern Baptist Convention, this is a very divisive issue. And what are they trying to do is basically make everybody happy and say, hey, you know, this side, it's we're all one big happy family. But what they're going to end up doing is, well, is any complementarian going to be pleased with this? No. And what about the egal?
They're like, oh, they're on the way.
Yeah.
Just come a little further.
Right. So, I mean, they're just going to get shot by both sides on this thing. And so this was extremely disappointing. Some of the exegesis and the things that he works through was helpful, and it kind of introduced me to some sources that I think I can build off of, which will be something I can use in the future. But as an overall movement, this complementarity, is this something that we are going to want to identify with or promote or any of that? And I'm like, it was just a miss. Complementarity.
So, I'm sorry, I was tracking, but thinking, you have finished it?
I did.
Give it a ranking.
Oh boy, I'm going to put it on the goodness scale because, you know, I'm not sure how, if this is going to ever, you know, if it's going to take off, are people going to start like interacting with it or whatever, but it is a monumental work. I mean, the thing's like 500 pages and he's very comprehensive going through the Old Testament, New Testament. He has like a chapter on the Pauline passages that's almost 100 pages long. Hmm. So there's a lot of resources, in this book. So I still think it's helpful, but I'm only going to give it like a 1.
Okay.
Well, let's have a conversation about Josef Pieper's Leisure, The Basis of Culture, and we're not going to go through the whole work at this point. If this episode goes okay, we might have a part 2 later, but I'm just going to be covering the preface in the first 2 chapters of this short work.
Sounds kind of ominous.
Well, it's easy to get lost in the weeds in this kind of stuff when you start discussing.
It'll be amazing.
So the context, Josef Pieper is a German Catholic philosopher. Each one of those words matters. He lived 1904 to 1997.
Yeah.
But so he's writing this book in 1947. And he opens with a relatively provocative question. And even the title of the book is somewhat compelling. But it's in the aftermath of World War II. He's German. And he's basically saying, you know, he's taking on the voice of his opponents. And they're asking him, why, in this context, would you suggest that we need to be thinking about leisure when our culture and civilization is in ruins, and the task that lies before us is rebuilding our culture? Why would you say that we need to be thinking about leisure? And he responds to that, and he says, well, that's precisely why we need to be talking about leisure, because leisure is the basis for the culture that we need to rebuild. And leisure has fallen on hard times. People don't understand it. They don't understand its proper place or purposes. And so he says that's what he's going to do, is rehabilitate our understanding of leisure. So he begins, and he makes the claim in the preface that culture depends for its very existence on leisure. How does that strike each one of you, that statement?
To me, I think it makes sense, because culture is what you cultivate, and you can't do that if you're working 24/7 and exhausted. Like, the things that we want to cultivate that are good things, you need time to do that. But maybe that's not what he means by leisure.
I think, and you being a Greek teacher would understand that the Greek word for leisure is skole. Which I don't know if that's probably classical, not Koine. Do you have that in?
No, I don't. We don't have that. But that just sounds like the scholes that you've talked about before.
Yeah. So we'll get into the etymology in a little bit. But yeah, you're definitely onto something there. Do you have any thoughts, Charlie or Tim, about the idea that culture depends for its existence on leisure?
So coming in cold. My thought first went.
I think
to...
it's the other way around.
Coming in cold. So thinking of a country or a, you know, you can't say culture, but a civilization that has no leisure. So like, what would I envision when I think of that? And my first thought was a communist country. Where, like, everybody does exactly what they're told at the exact right time. they're all given the same thing, and there's complete equity. And so, like, nobody really has a choice of how they spend their time, of what resources they have. And so what is the culture of a civilization like that? And try to, that was my first thought. But then just that statement, would I be correct in taking it like a causal, like a causal sense? So your leisure, what a civilization leisures, the leisure of a culture causes, the leisure of a civilization causes its culture. Is that kind of what he's saying?
Or creates, maybe.
Like, one is a direct result of the other.
Mm-hmm.
Yes? I haven't read the book, but I think that that makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
As we think through, I would agree with it. And as we think through, you know, what makes a culture, is it the production value that it possesses? It's not typically considered, oh, what kind of a culture that they, do they have is by what they produce. It's more along the lines of what they do with the time, the quote-unquote extra time that they have. And as you think through, like, biblical and theological and the Old Testament, you know, what was their culture? Well, it was geared around its worship of the one true God. So an aspect of leisure is one's religion. And so the religion is then the... If I'm understanding this correctly, and what he's arguing is that's why a culture depends on its existence, on its depends for its very existence on leisure. And that leisure is then connected to who you are as a people, because what do you do with that time?
I guess so. What you said kind of begs the question of what is culture? So culture includes religion. It's not only religion. It's not
right.
So. Do we?
But your religion's going to affect the leisure that you have.
Exactly.
And then the definition of your culture.
Yeah. Do we, at this point, do we make an attempt at defining culture, or is that coming?
I can tell you what Pieper, or how Pieper defines it. But let me tie some things together. So culture depends on leisure. And Tim is right to say that leisure depends on religion, what he describes as cultus, the things that you, the care, that that's a word that comes from a Latin, right? The care, the cultivation, or the worship of something. And then also the, so it's, there's kind of a agricultural reference there, but there's also a religious side where you're protecting the things where you worship God. And so that's really important. But he defines culture in his preface. He says, culture, in the sense in which we used it above, is the quintessence of all the natural goods of the world and of those gifts and qualities which, while belonging to man, lie beyond the immediate sphere of his needs and wants. And so there, Tim mentioned, I think you mentioned something about productivity or productive.
Yeah.
And that tends to be how we think of leisure, in some sense. So in a industrial country, being at leisure can sometimes be seen as being wasteful because you're not producing something. And he's going to argue that what you're producing is doesn't have an essential function necessarily in an industrial kind of country, but it serves a really important purpose, and that is that you continue to cultivate your religious faith, your beliefs, those kinds of things. He talks a little bit in the preface. He kind of raises three essential ideas that he's going to develop as he continues on. Culture is not mere productivity. Culture consists of what transcends utility. And that requires leisure. Then he goes into describing the fact that we have forgotten the true meaning of leisure. And he gives some etymology, Greek, the skole, that's the word leisure in Greek, Latin, the schola, German, the schule, and English, the school. Education originally was closely associated with leisure. And we've forgotten about that. And so one of the things that he's going to do in this essay, in these chapters, is make a distinction between the servile arts and the liberal arts.
This is where the distinction comes from? This book?
Well, one of them.
This is fantastic.
It's a distinction from the ancient world.
Wow.
To, I think, Aristotle and others make that distinction. But
So connecting the dot to the modern vernacular, we still have in our language today the liberal arts. I don't think anyone has probably heard, like, there's no servile art degrees.
Oh, there are. Lawyer, doctor.
Yeah, we don't have term.
Yeah.
We have segmented that out of our
trade school, so what we call it now.
So.
Yeah, and a lot of liberal arts, quote unquote liberal arts degrees, are servile in nature to a degree also. He says that the Greeks used to say, we are not at leisure in order to be at leisure. We are not at leisure in order to be at leisure. Which is to say, we work so that we can cultivate our culture as we are in leisure. And I think we still have some vestiges of that in our culture, but for us it's often, we are not at leisure so that we can amuse ourselves with mindless activities. It's kind of... And he quotes Max Weber, who says, what does he say? One does not only work in order to live, but one lives for the sake of one's work. And that's Weber describing kind of the predicament of modern man. That would be a description of somebody who no longer understands the proper place of leisure. Work has become total. And Pieper's going to describe, an environment of total work. Then he turns to the distinction I made earlier, thinking about the Christian and classical heritage, and there's a distinction between contemplation and work. And the liberal arts are the sphere of contemplation, and the servile arts are the sphere of work. And Pieper says, very practically, as you think about this, servile work is the work that you cannot do on the Sabbath. The work of the liberal arts, and I shouldn't use work, the activities of the liberal arts, the contemplation associated with the liberal arts is something that you can do on the Sabbath. And he doesn't do much with that distinction. He just kind of drops it in there for a moment, and he's going to then move on. So a couple of takeaways from chapter one. Modernity's valuation of work is radically different from that of the ancient world and the Middle Ages. We no longer understand the quotation commonly used by the Greeks, we are not at leisure in order to be at leisure. Mm-hmm. Work has invaded the whole realm of human existence. Mm-hmm. And then we instinctively grant moral prestige to the person who works. And those final two points are what he's going to begin to develop a little bit more. So in chapter two, he asks the question, how did we begin to start describing thinking as work?
This is fascinating. Seriously, Josh, this is really fascinating.
So he begins to investigate the origin of the idea that thinking itself is labor or is work. Once tradesmen envied philosophers, but now philosophers are intellectual workers doing intellectual work. Well, how does this happen? And he describes three developments. The first one is, and I'll just give all three and then we'll talk about them a little bit. The first one is, he says, all knowing has been reduced to discursive effort. And on its face, that might not make much sense to you. But we'll talk about what discursive means and what he's going through. That's development number one. Development number two, if I can find it here, is effort as the measure of truth and goodness. So we've started to describe effort The more effort you put into something, the better it is.
That sounds like the grading scheme in my elementary school growing up. We got ones, twos, and threes, not A, B, C, D, F.
Interesting.
And then you'd get a one in your content, and then you'd also get a grade for your effort. And you wanted one in efforts, because then if you got a three in your grade, it was okay because you tried really hard.
So that's the second development. And then the third development is intellectual work serves a social function. All right, so let's talk about these three things, try to make a little bit of more sense of them. So again, the question that he's asking in chapter two is, how did we begin to think about intellectual work, as labor? Development number one, knowing was reduced to discursive effort. And he begins and he describes there's two ways of seeing or two ways of knowing. So let's say that you and I are walking in the Lake District in England and we come across some golden daffodils on the side of the pond, right? I'm getting us to think about Wordsworth's emotion recollected in tranquility. And
that's
all
exactly
that.
What I thought of was Wordsworth. Culture.
Literature.
I'm not even kidding. That's exactly what I thought of.
Exactly. These literature guys. Horrendous.
So there's a couple of ways that you can think about those daffodils, right? So you can look at a daffodil and you can enjoy its beauty, its shape, its color. Simply looking at something, you're gazing at it, you're taking it in. It's open to your eyes to receive the things that are present themselves, that present themselves to us, that come to us without any need for effort on our part to possess them. Another way that we might interact with that daffodil is we might observe it, measure it, count its petals, dissect it, etc. That's not the same thing as observing it or taking it in. One is passive, one is active. And he says, what, you know, most people are going to understand that distinction when you're talking about something that is perceptible to the senses. Oh yeah, I can enjoy the beauty of a daffodil, and oh yeah, I can really look carefully at it and figure out all of its parts and those kinds of things. That makes sense. But then he asks the question, what do you do with things that are imperceptible to the senses? Is there such a way of looking or just taking in something that's imperceptible to the senses? Or do you have to put in some sort of serious intellectual work? So Pieper says, according to modern philosophers, there is no such thing as just taking in something that's imperceptible to the senses. But for the ancients and the medieval philosophers, there is a way of just passively receiving something intellectually. Well, how did we get to the point where we think of intellectual work not as being something that's passive and that you can receive something given to you? And instead, we think of it as you have to work to understand things. Well, he takes it back to Immanuel Kant and his critique of pure reason. And for Kant, to know something is exclusively discursive, which means it requires investigating, comparing, distinguishing, abstracting, deducing, and proving. It's all activity, and for Kant, it's nothing but activity. There's no mere kind of looking. There's nothing passive about it. Some of the consequences of this then are, of course, philosophy becomes work. Thinking becomes production. And if you think about that list, investigating, comparing, distinguishing, abstracting, deducing, proving, can you think of any kinds of thinking that are missing from that list?
Creative thinking. Like there's no creativity.
The word that came to my mind was imagination.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It also sounds like Bloom's taxonomy.
Sleeping.
What?
Just the art of just thinking through something. And so you just are resting and you think. So rest, think, and pray.
Yeah. Something kind of contemplative, contemplating something. But you're not squeezing it like an orange for all it's worth. You're not.
Well, and most of those words, too. Could you read them again?
Investigating, comparing, distinguishing, abstracting, deducing, proving.
And none of those are really in any sense something that's emotive. Like there's no feeling in any of those. Mm-hmm. They're very cold, or mm-hmm. At least how they are practiced in modernity would be very clinical. Like who you are and your own thought on the matter really is irrelevant to do most of those activities. So it's an unbiased list of activity.
Mm-hmm. It has we just started the scientific revolution in Western Civ, and it has all the feel of where we're going to get to in the Enlightenment, where you have like Diderot trying to make this encyclopedia thing where we can capture all knowledge and we've got to capture all of it. And there's not like any, it sounds very much like very enlightened, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is a development, because in the ancient world and in the medieval world, it's not as though they didn't think that this kind of thinking is important, but they had a separate category. So in the ancient world and the medieval world, they have ratio, which is discursive reasoning or thinking, the kind of thinking that Kant is arguing for, searching, comparing, concluding. And they would even argue that's kind of essentially what makes human knowing, those activities. But there's a second category, and that is intellectus, and that simple intellectual vision, or we might say something along the lines of kind of like an intuition or a knowing that is more passive, or a contemplation, a delight in just thinking. Truth presenting itself like a landscape to the eye, for example. It's receptive rather than active. And they would argue that this is actually the kind of thinking that is more prevalent in beings that are spiritual beings. Angels, for example, would have kind of a direct intuition about things. They don't necessarily have to reason through things the way that you and I would. And I found this interesting. Thinking through that reminded me of Paradise Lost. These literary guys. So in book 5 of Paradise Lost, the angel Raphael is educating Adam on creation. Adam tells him, you know, what were things like? How did this all come to be? And Raphael is giving him some insight, and he helps Adam understand some fine distinctions among living sentient things. And this is the quotation: "To vital spirits aspire, to animal, to intellectual, give both life and sense, fancy and understanding, whence the soul, reason receives, and reason is her being, discursive or intuitive." So there's the distinction. You either, reason includes both discursive and intuitive knowledge. Discourse is often yours, Adam, as a human being. The kind of reason that you're going to use is discursive. The latter most is ours. So angels have this kind of intuitive knowing.
So that is absolutely fascinating. And Andy, angels having an intuition, what does that instantly make me think of?
I'm ashamed. I don't know.
The answer to these questions is always the hideous strength.
Yes, it is.
Wait.
It actually wasn't that hideous strength. I'm thinking of like Out of the Silent Planet, where Ransom ends up having a conversation with the Oyarsa.
Oh, that's right.
Of this other planet. And actually throughout the whole story that Lewis writes, it's Ransom, I don't want to use the word intellect because it's the wrong word, but he in his human reasoning is trying to figure out why these other sentient beings do what they do. Mm-hmm. And like trying to explain humanity to them. And then eventually his conclusion's like, I'm the bent one. Like, we're the ones that have it all wrong. Like these creatures who are just living out their design, and it's so common and basic to them. Like, you know, like why would we need to have more children? Why would we ever fight in war about food? Like, you know, these look really silly things to them, but it's like, the rational human can't get his mind on it. And he eventually is like, yeah, well, it's because we're bent. Like, we're sinners. And the end of the book is with an angel that tries to explain this to him. But just and Lewis would have certainly read this, right? So, anyway, was, yeah, you, minus 1 point, Andy, for not ripping
out. I'm embarrassed. I'm embarrassed. Trilogy. But Out of the Silent Planet, I would say at the table, that's your book. Like, you have probably done more with that than any of us.
What are you trying to say?
No, I'm just saying, like, that's a good book.
Anyway.
Yeah, you made a big, huge deal about the stupid, weird animals on Out of the Silent Planet.
They're
I was
so
the one
cool.
that talked about Paralandra.
The Harasa.
Yeah, those things.
The Thorns. Or the Cerrone and
what
Plural.
Did I do? Keep going, Josh.
So, with Kant, then, and others, you get rid of intellectus, which is a knowing that doesn't require work, and all you're left with is ratio, discursive knowledge, which requires work. And Pieper says there's two implications from this. If you adopt the Kantian perspective, first, it makes a demand on the human being, which is, if you want to understand something, you have to work for it. The second implication is that there's a demand made by the human being. If knowing is work and exclusively work, then the one who knows only the fruit of his own subjective activity and nothing else. There is nothing in his knowing that is not the fruit of his own efforts. There is nothing received in it. And so from a Christian perspective, this is obviously problematic because God is knowledge and wisdom, and we know only that which he reveals to us. The second development, the view that the effort that goes into thought is the criterion of its truth. This is kind of interesting. Let me see if I can switch notes here. So the effort that you put into something determines its truth or its goodness. And he makes a moral parallel. And again, he refers back to Kant, and he says, for Kant, moral goodness opposes natural inclination. The harder something is, the more virtuous it is. And Pieper uses the example of the biblical principle, love your enemy. We might hear that, and we think that's the most difficult kind of love of all, but it's the best kind of love of all. And Pieper says, well, Aquinas is going to come along and he's going to say, well, actually, if you can love your enemy effortlessly, if you could do that, wouldn't that be a higher love? And I was thinking a little bit about this, and I actually wrote in my book, was it hard for Jesus to love his enemies?
That's a good question. That is an interesting way to look at it, Josh. Wow.
And I'm not going to come to any conclusions on that right now, but that's the kind of question that Pieper is wanting us to ask. So Aquinas is kind of an alternative or a corrective to Kant. Of course, Aquinas comes before Kant, so we're going back in time, thinking again the categories that the medievals possessed. Aquinas offers a different view. He says the essence of virtue consists more in the good than in the difficult. So virtue, according to Aquinas, it doesn't crush inclination, but it actually perfects inclination. And this is where you get some of the Catholicism of Pieper, and he's relying heavily on Aquinas. The third development is intellectual work as a social function. And he says this is actually even more crucial than the previous two developments. But work now becomes to mean only that which is a contribution to society. So intellectual work means intellectual activity as a social service. All thinking then becomes utilitarian. And it flattens the distinction between the liberal arts and the servile arts. So the liberal arts, it's kind of an ordered knowing that's justified in itself. The servile arts, ordered to utility, justified by external results. And then you get the distinction of education versus training. And the problem, of course, that we face is that modern institutions blur this distinction all the time. Education actually becomes training, and students, as consumers, are seeking skills, marketability, economic utility. That's what they're pursuing. And I kind of wrote this down. They want intellectual work in order to be at work. They come to these colleges and universities thinking that they're going to be getting an education, but what they're actually seeking is to do intellectual work so they can serve a social function, so they can be a productive member of society. And Pieper does acknowledge, he says, professional training is legitimate. The normal day, after all, is a working day. But he asks some essential questions. He asks, can the world of man be exhausted in being in the working world? Or can human existence be fulfilled in being exclusively a workaday existence? That second question, I'll say it again. Can human existence be fulfilled in being exclusively a workaday existence? And he's going to argue the ancients would definitely say no to that, right? And you and I probably sense some of that as well. There needs to be room for contemplation. There needs to be room for thought that is not directly functional or utilitarian. That's, of course, what the liberal arts offer you, is space and room to contemplate things. He says, on page 25, it should go without saying that not everything that cannot exactly be categorized as useful is useless. So a lot of the things that you discuss in the liberal arts, you know, parents like, should my son pursue this literature degree or this philosophy degree? Now, often if the university's enmeshed in modern philosophy, it's not a good idea to pursue a philosophy degree. But if you have a good school that's conservative in its orientation, yeah, thinking about philosophy and literature, the humanities, these can be really good things, but they don't have a quote-unquote marketable or practical outcome directly tied to the education. Of course, people pursuing these things are going to be highly functional and going to be able to give you and provide for you things that you'd want in an employee, but they're not being trained in manipulation of spreadsheets and, you know, deep mathematical principles and things like that.
So then, would the outcome of a true education be located almost purely in the person, and the outcome of training be located almost purely in what the person knows how to do? Is that a fair assessment of what he's, is that like?
The second part of that I definitely think is true. The first part,
like, you know, you're a different person because of your education, but it doesn't mean you necessarily do anything. Well, I guess you do different things.
But you don't do things that are utilitarian, yeah, necessarily. Yeah. So anyway, we'll wrap it up here because we're running long on time. But the primary claims of these first chapters, first, leisure is the foundation of culture. Second, modernity has redefined thinking as work. And third, when all knowing becomes work, culture collapses into utility.
Communism.
Right.
Yeah. Do I get to make another comment about the Out of the Silent Planet, Tim?
Oh, my grandma used to do that. Like, when she wouldn't like something, she'd go, Tim just grandma'd you, man.
Well, what's so interesting to me...
It's not going to matter. He's going to do it anyway.
Oh, it's 100%.
I know, but I called you a grandma on air. That kind of sounded fun.
So... The three beings on Melisandre, they all focus on different aspects of what Josh just said.
That's true.
There's one that's all hands-on. They're the ones making things with their hands, the Fiffle Triggy. They're very different, Tim. Hush you.
Hey, Grandma.
Hush you.
Keep it down.
Then there's the Sorns, and they're the ones that are the rational thinkers. And over... the Harasa are like, well, the Sorns would know that. They'd be able to think that through for you. And then what do the Harasa do? They're the ones that are the poets. And so you have all three aspects of the education that leisure comprise, or I guess not all of them are leisure, but all of the things you just discussed, there are, they're separated out for us in those beings. And I did do some Google searches. Pieper does quote Lewis, and apparently Lewis at times interacts directly with Pieper. And so I don't know if that's coming. So I think we do need more parts of the series, but like, is that a part of the way that all of these guys are looking at, you know, what a good life would be? And here's a world without sin. And what is there? It's not without sin, but it's beings unaffected by sin. And these three distinct categories are there in rational beings. And they're all together working with each other. So very interesting.
So now, the contrary, think about Weston and Divine.
Yeah.
They're literally the breaking down of this in some ways. Because everything is what you can use it for. What can you get out of it? Mm-hmm. It's the contrary philosophy. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
And I'll just conclude by kind of reemphasizing what you're saying, Charlie, and that is, in a world where the beings are not affected by sin, all three of these things exist. So I am not at all, and Pieper is not at all saying the servile arts are bad.
Yeah.
He's just saying a robust culture has space for not merely utilitarian things, but there are some things that are related to contemplation, to knowing, that's a gift or something that's received rather than just thinking of it as intellectual work.
And there's one of my favorite parts of that book is where the human gets sent to the Sorn, and the Sorn says something to the effect of, the Harassa shouldn't have done this, you know. You could have died because the air is so thin up here, but you would have done that. And they would have written poetry and made songs about the man who went and died on the Harandra. And it's just such a funny little moment where it's like, those silly poets don't know that there's no air up here. Anyway, let's have a final thought from God's word. And as we mentioned earlier, it'll be Galatians 5 here. And I'm preaching through this on Sunday, and so I've thought a little bit about the passage. The main kind of theme of Galatians 5, it is talking about being free, and specifically in context, being free from law. A Christian does not earn any favor with God. Their justification before him is completely earned in Christ. Galatians 2 says, if righteousness could be earned by the law, Christ died in vain. We understand that the gospel tells us we do not earn salvation. Once I am saved, does the law need to be a part of my life? For example, in specific context in Galatians 5, do Christians need to be circumcised to be faithful, godly people? And Paul's point, Paul's theme, no, you do not. You are freed from the bondage of the law, and you have a much better rule of your life, which is the Spirit. And that's really the thrust of Galatians 5 is going to lead to verse 16, walk in the Spirit, and you don't fulfill the lust of the flesh. When you walk in the Spirit, none of your actions have laws against them. The Spirit makes love. There's no laws against love. Now, I know our modern context could take that snippet right there and just do a lot of things with it. But what the Spirit of God produces, if you have that, you aren't breaking God's laws. My sermon's not on verse 16. It's 13 through 15. So let me read that. For you were called to freedom, brothers. Only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another. For the whole law is fulfilled in one word. I think it's hilarious. He then quotes a whole verse. This is a Baptist preacher. For the whole law is fulfilled in one word. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Obviously, the word is love. But verse 15. But if you bite and devour one another, watch out that you are not consumed by one another. You're going to get a really quick snapshot of my sermon here. Why do we need to learn and live in freedom as Christians? Number one, this was our calling. Dead in sin, no life, no righteousness. It was not our decision to choose Christ out of our intelligence, out of our rational being. God called to us through his Son. And that calling in the gospel was to free us from the law. The moment you start trying to live by law, you are not doing what God has called you to do. So purpose. You are called to freedom. Two, the only alternative to freedom in the spirit is flesh. And guess what your flesh does? The works of the flesh are evident. Sexual immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, strife, jealousy, fits of anger, rivalries, dissensions, divisions, envy, drunkenness, orgies, things like these. I warn you as I warned you before that those who do such things will not inherit the kingdom of God. If you choose to not live in the freedom of Christ, you are actually going to be a lawbreaker, not a lawkeeper. You do not have a better alternative as a Christian in lawkeeping. You will go to default, which is flesh, and it causes lots of problems. So why do we need to walk in freedom? It's what you're called to. It's a much better alternative to your flesh. Verse 14, actually walking in the Spirit is the only way we fulfill the law. We're not required to, but we actually do live out the righteous requirement of the law if we can, in love, serve other people. If the fruit of God's Spirit is working in us, we do, in a complete sense, fulfill the law. The whole law is fulfilled in love. That is the first fruit of the Spirit. If you live in freedom and the Spirit of God controls you, you are going to be a holy person. You are fulfilling the whole law. Not required, but that is practically what happens when you walk in the Spirit. So why freedom? It's your calling. Your only alternative is flesh. You fulfill the law. And then verse 15 is a warning. If you do not, you will destroy your relationships. A fleshly life will lead to biting and devouring. And there's very few things that I bite and devour. It's a really nice picture. You know, you're just voraciously hungry and some food gets put on the table and it's just absolutely destroyed. It's gone. It's decimated. And Paul says, better be careful. If you're trying to live a righteous life and you think the way to do that is the law, your flesh is going to take advantage by that law. And you in pride and self-righteousness are going to assert yourself against all of these other people. And it's going to destroy you. It's going to absolutely ruin your relationships. You're going to consume one another. It's a very interesting picture. And so four good reasons to be free in Christ and to live under the Spirit's control. And I think it's interesting that that is the devotional as we talk about leisure, which, you know, what do you do when you don't work? How do you spend your time? Well, there's a lot of great ways to spend your time, but you need to make sure that your freedom, the choices you make, are spirit-filled ones, and that you are choosing to love and serve other people rather than in your flesh bite and devour. So hopefully that is a helpful challenge and a blessing to you. Thanks for listening to this episode, and we will see you next week.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Thinklings Podcast. We would love to hear from you. If you have any feedback, suggestions, or potential topics that you'd like us to discuss, you can contact us through our email, thinklingspodcast@gmail.com. Remember, don't let this conversation end with this podcast. Read good books, talk about them with your friends, and always continue to cultivate your mind. See you next time on the Thinklings Podcast.